You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Now, the first thing to say is I know regular listeners tune in excitedly in December to hear our end of year rundown of the biggest physics stories of the year with Ian Durham. Do not fear, Ian will be joining me as usual for our festive countdown next week. But I could not resist throwing together a bonus edition to celebrate the planned launch of the world's biggest space telescope, the JWST, coming up later in this edition, and also the chance to talk about a recent preprint by FQXI member and quantum physicist at Oxford University, Vlatko Vedral, which has caused quite a stir on social media. Vedral and his colleagues posted a paper in December describing an experiment led by Raina Dumka at the Centre of Quantum Technologies in Singapore, provocatively titled Entanglement Between Superconducting Qubits and a Tardigrade. Also known as water bears or moss piglets, these small but hardy multicellular microorganisms have 8 legs, a little face, and an incredible ability to survive harsh conditions. You'll be able to tell from the interview coming up that just thinking about these cute critters makes me giggle. In the lab, a tardigrade was put into a state of cryptobiosis, basically being to all intents and purposes temporarily dead at an ultra-cold temperature, and coupled to a superconducting qubit system. Unsurprisingly, the feat made headlines. But there's also been a bit of a backlash, with some physicists on social media questioning whether the experiment really describes entanglement at all. Jay Gambetta, of IBM Quantum Computing, tweeted that the team had done little more than put a tardigrade on a qubit. Harsh words. So, as you can imagine, I was keen to catch up with Vlatko Vedral earlier this week and find out more about the experiment and how he responds to the criticisms. Congratulations on this tardigrade paper. The first time a sort of a multicellular organism has been quantum entangled. I saw this on Twitter. I don't know if you're on social media a few days ago. And, you know, everybody's going crazy about this.
My students told me about it. They said there was a media storm.
Some of us were, you know, sort of amused, bemused, confused, excited. And then there's been a bit of controversy as well.
Yes.
We also, as I'm sure you know, run a special edition of the podcast over the Christmas week with Ian Durham, in which he chooses his top stories of the year. We haven't recorded that yet. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty certain that this is going to come up there.
That would be great.
Along with some of the controversy about it.
Actually, I'm very happy to probe all of these aspects as well.
My first reaction when I saw this paper, which Ian had actually shared on Twitter, which was, what? Why? Why would you do this? I mean, this poor tardigrade, what have you done? Is it like some kind of weird Frankenstein type thing that's going on here? What is the motivation for doing this?
Good question. You may want to call it macroscopic quantum physics. You may want to call it quantum biology. You may want to call it whatever you like. The motivation is simply testing quantum mechanics outside of the micro domain. You know, the standard argument is that living systems are large, warm, and wet, which creates a very challenging environment for quantum mechanics to survive this. Now, why tardigrade maybe? Because, I mean, it's a cute animal. You have to admit, you know, there is a kind of wow factor about it as well. But I think the choice simply is because of the robustness. Under normal circumstances, all they do is move around and look for food, and they don't do much else. Actually, they're very cute. They look extremely sweet, but they're pretty boring as kind of living systems. You know, they're very basic. What tardigrades did in the past is, I think, people blasted them in a rocket. I think some of them landed on the moon, and apparently they're still there. Raina Dumka, who was the experimental leader in charge of this experiment in Singapore, simply has superconducting qubits. For them to operate coherently in the quantum regime, you have to go down to the millikelvin temperatures, 10,000 times colder than the room temperature. And this is exactly to achieve the right conditions for the qubit to be a qubit, in fact.
I'm going to put a link to the paper on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. And I would encourage people to take a look just for the pictures because, you know, there's a nice little image there of the tardigrade on the qubits. You're a theoretical physicist. Have you actually been to the lab and seen what they're doing, given that there's a pandemic and you probably can't travel that easily? Because it sounds like so much fun that you kind of want to see what's going on when you've got a little tardigrade involved.
I'm familiar with Rainer's labs, actually, from maybe a couple of years ago, exactly as you said, before the pandemic. And you're right, it's big fun. Let me give you a picture of the experiment. The biggest constraint, really, experimentally speaking, is the fridge. These are highly sophisticated cryogenic pieces of equipment that go down to a millikelvin, 1,000 times colder than the outer space. So your dominant bit is the fridge, which provides the scaffolding within which this qubit is really inserted to be maintained at these low temperatures and pressures. And of course, that has to be done once the tardigrade has been inserted into this capacitor. What was very important is that the size of the tardigrade is the right size to fit within the capacitor plates inside the superconducting qubit. And I think this one was about 1.5 millimeters, which was just about big enough. If you look at these pictures, it almost fills the capacitor completely. The tardigrade reaches this state of TUN, right? T-U-N, which is this suspended motion, right? Almost like a hibernation, but I don't think a biologist would like me to say hibernation because I think the mechanism is very different. It doesn't really fall asleep. It gets rid of all the water, because of course, this could be detrimental when things freeze. And somehow it achieves almost a state of being dead, so to speak, but not completely because it's obviously able to revive from that state afterwards. And I think what happened afterwards is simply that Rainer took it out, inserted it into a droplet of water. And very quickly after that, the tardigrade revived. It was very surprising that they could be revived from these kind of conditions. Like I said, even biologically speaking, I think this is a new result for biologists. But like I said, for us as physicists, we thought that it was simply remarkable that even in this state, it was able to achieve this kind of quantum mechanical entanglement.
Partly because a lot of the criticisms that have come up in terms of the definition of entanglement and what entanglement means. So if you can, first of all, just explain to us what you mean by entanglement here.
Yes, it's very important to actually spell this out carefully. When all you read is a very short New Scientist piece and a few Twitters, it's very hard to actually get to the bottom of the physics here. What we are talking about is electrical charge. We are talking about electrons that could exist in two different places at the same time. So we are talking about the good old superposition, and where the qubit has two states, electrons can be sitting on one of these superconducting islands, they could be sitting on the other. And now what a qubit really achieves is a superposition of these two states, where the electrons can now exist across both of these islands simultaneously. Now, what you want to say is that a tardigrade now responds to this charge, in the sense that normally a tardigrade would be completely neutral, electrostatically speaking. However, when you induce a current in the vicinity of the tardigrade is basically a collection of dipoles. So something inside the tardigrade responds to a superposition of charge in the superconducting qubit. And this is something that in physics we call an induced dipole. And the entanglement now that we want to claim exists between the dipoles inside the tardigrade and the state of the qubit. So how would that look? If the charge is on one superconducting island, then the dipoles in the tardigrade exist in one particular state. And if the charge is in the other superconducting island, then the dipoles are in a different quantum mechanical state.
You know, as I'm listening to this and you're talking about inducing dipoles, I've got this image in my head of when you, you know, you blow up a balloon and then you take it and you rub it on your shirt and then you stick it onto the wall or,
right.
Or let's say I stick it onto a cat or something. Would I say then that, you know, the balloon and the cat that it's stuck to are entangled? Is that not just a sort of a classical electrical effect?
You're right. This one is completely classical that you described. Possibly better way of talking about this is something that we call the van der Waals force. And this is the force that explains how two molecules get together to attract one another, even though when you separate them, they're perfectly electrically neutral. So this is something that classical physics cannot explain, precisely because if they're electrically neutral, classical electrostatics would just tell us that they should never respond to one another. They shouldn't even be aware of the presence of one another. Even, I think, tardigrades may be using van der Waals force to go around in their own environment.
Let me go back again to something that you sort of said when you were talking about the setup of the experiment. And you started off by saying you have a qubit and your qubit is in a superposition, and then you're going to bring in your tardigrade and your tardigrade becomes entangled with the qubit. Is the tardigrade in some kind of superposition now?
Yeah, this goes to the heart of the matter. When they are maximally entangled, the qubit and the tardigrade, then neither of them is in a superposition. They are actually in a perfectly mixed state. That's exactly how Schrödinger talked about how amazing entanglement was, because he said, look, it seems that each of the subsystems, we don't know anything about it. It could be in any state, but the state together is perfectly known to us. And now coming to your question of controversy, now you can say, oh, that's all very nice, but if you want to confirm this entanglement, you need to be able to measure the qubit and independently the tardigrade. And strictly speaking, this wasn't done in the experiment. This would be an extremely hard experiment because the tardigrade is actually sitting inside the qubit. It comes as a package, if you like. For us to be able to treat them individually, we would have to somehow take the tardigrade out and separate it from the qubit, hoping that during all of this time, entanglement is preserved. Almost certainly it wouldn't be, by the way. I'm just saying that's exactly the difficulty. And then subsequently measuring the tardigrade independently from the superconducting qubit. And that, of course, would be a marvelous experiment to do. But this is kind of a first step in that direction.
I can see that you're sort of addressing the criticism and acknowledging it, that there's another step to this experiment that has to be done. And that might be very far in the future, if ever, because it's very difficult to kind of take away your little tardigrade and do an independent measurement on him. But let's go back. Talk us through exactly what happened with this experiment. Where I'm going with this is to find out if there is sort of an equivalent experiment that's already been done with completely inanimate objects where entanglement in this kind of situation has been demonstrated. So you can kind of say, well, by analogy, we think this has happened with a tardigrade.
Excellent. That's an excellent statement, actually. In fact, the first thing I thought of are the Nobel Prize winning experiment of Serge Haroche, vacuum Rabi splitting. So you take a very small optical cavity. So you trap light between two highly reflecting mirrors. Haroche can literally produce any number of photons inside this cavity. You say, Serge, please, can I have 10 photons? He says, no problem. He presses the button, he makes 10 photons. How does he do that? He sends an atom that's excited flying through this cavity. And when it's inside the cavity, it becomes de-excited and deposits a photon. If you look at the energy between the two energy levels when the atom is outside, and then you record the same thing when you put the atom inside the cavity, you will see that there is a shift. The reason why they shift is because now the two atomic energy levels strongly couple to photons, and these photons shift these energy levels, and that's what's known as vacuum Rabi splitting. So somehow the coupling between light in the cavity and the atom induces a joint entangled state, and in fact, Haroche's experiments could confirm easily, because when the atom flies out, you can now measure possibly the cavity state with another atom and the outgoing atom independently, and you can confirm that the state is entangled. So this would be kind of the atomic physics equivalent of the experiments that Rainer did. Let me be a bit more self-critical as well here. It's a huge approximation to say that a whole, as you said, multicellular system really does respond as a two-level quantum system. And so that's the model that we have in mind. And in fact, when we wrote down the mathematical model for this, it's identical to what Haroche would have used in his own cavity QED. So that's why we are confident. We are thinking, look, we know the qubit is quantum mechanical. We know that there is an energy shift. And therefore, the most obvious mechanism that should induce this energy shift is really this dipole-dipole coupling between the two. What is interesting, Zia, by the way, is that if you now say, wait a second, can't I treat the tardigrade classically? You know, the qubit is quantum and the tardigrade is classical, will not give you the right energy shift. You just mathematically cannot explain this energy shift anymore. That's as confident as we can be. Because we couldn't measure the tardigrade separately, it means naturally that we needed to make extra assumptions in order to conclude that this is really a quantum entangled state. But if you really want a more conclusive experimental bit of evidence, then you would really have to somehow separate them, to a larger distance, and then measure them completely independently from one another.
That does actually make quite a bit of sense. And what exactly, you know, just going back to when the tardigrade is inside the experiment, what exactly is it you're measuring that tells you that you've got some kind of quantum thing happening here, entanglement or otherwise?
So you have to find these new energy levels, which were created because of the entanglement between the tardigrade and the qubit. So first you do the experiments without the tardigrade and you characterize your qubit fully. You show what the energy level splitting is. You show that you are able to make all sorts of superpositions between zero and one, just as you would to convince people that this is a good, legitimate qubit. And that's exactly what Rainer did, is you insert the tardigrade, and now you look for the new energy levels that are basically there precisely because of the shift due to the dipole-dipole coupling. So you excite the system, and then you let it naturally de-excite and emit radiation, and you measure the frequency of this radiation. What I thought I should mention, and maybe this gets lost in all of these media things, is that Rainer, in fact, did more than that. And I think this is one step beyond also anything that's been done before. He brought another superconducting qubit. So in fact, what he created, if this hypothesis is correct, that they are entangled, what he created is an entanglement between three subsystems, two of which were the two superconducting qubits, and the third was the tardigrade. So it's remarkable. You can think of the tardigrade and the superconducting qubit as a more complicated qubit, hybrid qubit, living and inanimate qubit, I think.
My question then is, okay, you've done this experiment and you've demonstrated some kind of quantum weird thing happening with the tardigrade system. But as you sort of explained at the start, when we think of quantum biology, when we think about quantum effects being able to last, we say, well, they can't happen in a biological system because it's too warm, it's too wet. But then we've taken this living system, but we've put him into sort of a condition where he's not really living. He's not warm and he's not wet. He's just a tiny little inanimate blob. So what does this really tell us? Does it get us anywhere forward in terms of quantum biology specifically?
That's an excellent point. In fact, this question is really whether we can learn anything about the functionality of this system. And I think the answer is probably no, as you outlined, in the sense that, well, certainly not from these experiments as they are. We would have to do more with it to really probe the biological side of things. But the simple answer, as you say, is imagine you have a dead tardigrade and you do exactly the same experiment. Would you expect the dead tardigrade to respond more or less the same way to the hibernating tardigrade? And again, I'm speculating, but I think it's almost obvious that the answer would be yes. And certainly you could have put anything else there. You know, my friend David Deutsch, immediately when I sent him these movies, I just couldn't resist. Basically, he immediately said, how do you know it's not a speck of dust on tardigrade's nose that actually entangles to the qubit? And of course you don't, you see, you just have to repeat the experiment many times in as clean conditions as you can. But anything else that happens to be part of this tardigrade could well also be responsible for the dipole-dipole interaction. It's extremely difficult to rule this out. We can never know this from these kind of crude experiments.
You had mentioned that, just sort of inadvertently maybe, the conditions involved in this experiment surprised biologists about what it means in terms of what tardigrades can endure. So I just wondered if you'd had any sort of discussion or feedback from biologists about maybe the implications beyond physics, but maybe in biology for this.
So I think I had some discussions with some biologists about this issue. And as I mentioned, the van der Waals forces, there are papers written about tardigrades using the van der Waals force. I mean, of course, if you talk to a biologist, then van der Waals forces really are dominant because we are talking about very small systems. They don't care about gravity, basically. But what means a lot to them is the molecules that surround them. And these are the molecules they have to worry about in terms of viscosity, friction, all sorts of other effects. These forces do play a role in the macroscopic world of tardigrade and many other animals. But I don't think anyone really linked it, as far as I can tell, to some genuine quantum mechanical effect inside the animal. So, for instance, what would be beautiful is whether even reaching this state of ton, or at least part of that mechanism, could be quantum mechanical. The question is really, how does one probe that? Can we play with these energy levels more? Can we introduce extra fields, for instance, to shift the resonances even further out and then see whether the tardigrade survives even something like this? Another idea that always comes to mind is to genetically modify the tardigrade and to modify somehow the internal structure. But I think for this, we would really need to understand what these dipoles are, where they are located, how collective is this response, how big is the volume. Our model is extremely crude. Like I said, we take the whole tardigrade as a collection of hundreds of millions of dipoles. If we were to do that, it's more likely to me to go back to some simpler organisms where we actually can maybe tell a bit more about what it is that they do with these kind of mechanisms.
So you're not planning on entangling a kitten or something in your next experiment?
Yeah. Yes, kitten, of course. Yeah, that's kittens are probably not enough in a sense. I think what you would like to have is a living system that you can conclusively communicate with. Now, of course, you can communicate with a kitten, but I don't know how conclusive it is. Obviously, a human being would be the ultimate to really make a kind of Schrodinger cat kind of experiment. My bets are on artificial intelligence. It's an educated guess. I have no strong reason to believe this, but I have a feeling that once we understand consciousness better, even 1,000 quantum bits could in fact simulate some rudimentary form of artificial intelligence. Even if you think 1,000,000 is needed, it's okay. We are going to have 1,000,000 qubits in a few years' time. So if you have this artificial intelligence, that's the experiment I would like to do. I would like to use this AI as an observer. It could be a superconducting qubit who couples to a superposition and then branches, as quantum mechanics says, and in one branch observes one state of the qubit, state zero, and in the other branch, this intelligence observes the state one. And then, as you know, quantum mechanics says, it's not either or, it's actually both. Both of these exist simultaneously in this entangled state. And now I would like to be able to interact with this AI and ask it, how do you feel now? What's the state of your mind? What it is that you see? I'm betting that this will happen with AIs before it happens with, you know, cats and dogs and humans and so on.
Wow. Okay. Thank you very much.
I like the fact that you covered the kind of controversial bits, because I think it's nice to communicate exactly what it is that was achieved and exactly what the shortcomings are. And I think no one on our team, obviously, is pretending that this is the final step. We all understand that, if anything, this is really just the first tiny step. And I am confident that sooner or later, we will get to the full measures of entanglement and we'll be able to confirm this in more detail. I really think it's just a matter of time and money.
And money.
Yeah, and in fact, by the way, I'm very happy to say that this project was initially funded by the Martin School, and they were very kind to give us about $2.5-3 million to do this. And this was about 10 years ago.
So I wonder what proportion of it you're giving to the tardigrade as compensation for taking part in this experiment.
That's right. I think no tardigrades were harmed during this experiment.
Thank you to Vladko Vedral for giving us a lovely description of the lab and the experiment there. Later in this edition, we'll have an experimental feature mixing interviews and some dramatisation to give you more of a sense of life in the quantum physics lab. So, thankfully no tardigrades were hurt in this experiment, but were they entangled? Has Vedral convinced you? As promised, we will be linking to his paper on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, and we will be returning to this experiment with Ian Durham next week in one of our special holiday editions when we look back at the physics highlights of the year. And we'll definitely be assessing the controversy that has blown up on social media surrounding this.